Actually, yeah, that's the one.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah, okay.
All right, welcome everyone to the first meeting of the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is February 2nd, 2017. Really excited to start off this next session with you all. We're going to just start with welcome and introductions, and I'll start with myself and then go to my vice chairs and then go on down the line. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. I represent House District 46, which is parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. My entire career from the time I was a high school student through odd jobs in college and summer and then a full-time career since then has been mostly around at-risk families and youth, so I'm really delighted to be chairing this committee. I have a master's in public health, and most of my career has been in the nonprofit world, running programs that had to do with children at risk. So director of Hannah Anderson Children's Foundation, Saturday Academy, outreach director, Multnomah County Commission on Children, Families, and Community, Portland Children's Levy, things like that. So I'm really delighted to be on this committee, and I'm passionate about these issues, some of the hardest issues, I think, that we deal with in the legislature. And I'm on crutches right now because I had surgery a week ago. So I'm sorry, I'm hobbling around a little bit. So
you haven't told us how you heard it, though.
I don't really know how I heard it. It got worse and worse throughout the fall.
It's supposed to be like rappelling down
the Andes. I had it worse. So when I broke my back in the middle of session in 2015, that was a little more exciting. This is not very exciting.
Oh, all right.
So anyway.
So Duane Stark, House District 4, which is in Southern Aragon, Oregon. Wow.
Aragon. Wow.
Sorry, believe it or not.
Aragon.
Southern Aragon.
Different planet.
I have a tough time speaking. My apologies. So, yeah, District 4, Southern Oregon, between Grants Pass and Medford, so it includes parts of Josephine and Jackson County, and love working on this committee. It's one of the areas in life I'm passionate about. When it comes to the Department of Human Services, between my wife and I, we have probably some sort of experience in almost every arena that we've come in contact with. We've been foster parents. We started over 8 years ago. We're adoptive parents. We're currently in the system with all that. That's always exciting. And so, the for a season, worked as in residential treatment. I've worked as, now I'm forgetting the right terminology. Anyway, all
personal
over in the department.
Worker.
Yes, thank you. So, direct support worker, personal support workers. My wife used to work at DHS. So, we kind of know the system pretty well. So, we love getting to work on that stuff here. When it comes to housing, that's just no fun because that's a mess. But we enjoy working on that once in a while. And glad to be here. Like to have some fun. And I take the work very seriously, but also like when we enjoy ourselves and enjoy the day because why not?
Mm-hmm. Good attitude. My new vice chair.
Yes. Tana Sanchez, House District 43, which is north and northeast Portland. In my other work, I'm the Director of Family Services at NAIA Family Center, so I've built and managed programs in domestic violence, foster care, aging and disability, and veteran services, early childhood programming, have subcontracts with DHS, actually, to do work for in-home safety and reunification services and other things. Been a foster parent for many, many years, and I have a master's degree in social work, so I'm a social worker. That's what I do. So.
Thank you. Great experience. Let's start on this end. Representative Noble.
Well, yeah. I'm Ron Noble, House District 24, which is North Yamhill County and South Washington County, from McMinnville to just a sliver of Hillsboro. I guess my former day job was law enforcement. Not that I guess. Actually, it was. and currently work at Linfield College in public safety. Really excited to be here. I don't have the same background, but I think I bring something different. Most of my family actually are medical providers, both in home health and then in clinical work. So I have a little bit of experience there. I do own a house, so from the housing standpoint. But I also have four kids who are also looking for homes. Mm. And so I experienced that side from the parent side. And then my in-laws also live with us. So we have a very interesting mix. Excited to be here and to participate.
So I'm Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50, which is Gresham with a little slice of Portland. Background also is law enforcement, so we're the chief's end of the
right
dais here, right here. I have known our chair for a long time. We both served on the Commission for Children's Families and Communities with Multnomah County. I like to say that I balanced my law enforcement career with working with the social services and nonprofits. Really jazzed to be again serving on this committee. It's my second term and my second opportunity to do this service. It is vitally important. I have a lot of respect for the folks in our DHS offices. We've been working pretty closely on some pretty good things, so want to continue to make that happen and do what we need to do for the best of our kids and our Oregon.
I'm Dallas Hurd, House District 2, Roseburg down to just shy of Grants Pass. I'm not from a background in law enforcement, but I've had many, many encounters.
But we said we wouldn't tell them about those encounters.
Probably should have had one on the way up here from Roseburg this morning. But anyway, my background professionally is landscape construction. I started out renting my first house with my wife, Hannah, about 800 square foot home. And we are homeowners now, so happy about that. Also, am a landlord still. I started out with 7 units when I came into this building, but I've whittled it down to 1. So I am excited to be on this committee, though. So
great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm Representative Mike Nierman from House District 23, which is kind of a big agricultural district with a bunch of little cities in it, going all the way from just south of Newburgh all the way down to the Lane County line. So when I'm looking out for law enforcement, it takes me 2 hours to drive north-south in my district there. So by trade, I'm a software engineer, so I don't really have enough social skills actually to get elected to the state legislature. So I'm also a landlord, so I have 4 rental properties in Salem. I think that's part of what got me on this committee. I think also I like to needle the speaker about housing issues sometimes, too. So I think my presence on this committee was a little bit of a punishment for that, maybe. And for a little tidbit of trivia here is, one of my tenants is in this room right now, and a prize to whoever can figure that out.
Very interesting. Good morning, Mark Meek from House District 40, which is Oregon City, Gladstone. And I do have a unique experience here because I am both a realtor, small business owner. I have my own small real estate company, but I've been selling and managing real estate for over 20 years. I'm also a property owner. I have my own properties. I'm in the middle of a 1031 exchange. For any of you guys on business and labor, you would understand what that is. But I bring a perspective of this side of management and dealing with the tenants. But also my background as a young man was I was a recipient of the Department of Housing Services as both, you know, receiving food stamps. My mom was on welfare, free lunch, and even through the foster care system. And so I have a real deep empathy for the folks and the services that you guys work for. And so I bring a unique experience and background. So I will be bringing all of my hats into the decision making and also the process of helping, you know, produce some good programs for all of our Oregonians. So nice to meet you all.
That's great. And I'll just mention that Representative Borsek could not be here today, but he is from the district representing Troutdale, I think parts of Gresham, also has a law enforcement background and is a professor at PCC, is passionate, particularly about housing, because that's a real crisis in East County. Mount Hood Community College.
Yes.
Did I say PCC?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. That's good. PCC on the brain. Mount Hood Community College. So, sorry he can't be here today to introduce himself, but you will get to know him very well. And I'd love our committee administrator and our committee assistant to introduce yourselves as well.
Great. Good morning, everyone. My name is Cassie Susi, and I am the committee analyst or administrator for this committee. I'm very excited to serve all of you and learn more about these issues and help facilitate the process. So if there's anything you need from our office, please let me know.
Great. Hi, I'm Ashley.
And you're new. And
yes, I've been here. This is my third session.
Third session. OK, great. All right, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your introductions. I will now open an organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting our committee rules. Cassie, could you please give us a brief overview?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the committee rules are modeled after the chamber rules, Within them, you'll find rules, the more specific rules regarding a quorum, rules amendments, meeting agendas, carryover items, subcommittees, votes on motions, petitions, seconds on motions, meeting minutes, attribution of sponsor requests, minority report deadlines, germaneness, minority report topics, amendment notice requirement, impact statements, and conflict of interest. These are identical for each committee for consistency, and they are all substantially similar to the previous session. The only change is going from short session to long session. So minority report deadlines are longer. They are, you have till the second following business day to give notice to deliver the minority report. These are posted and available on OLIS.
So on OLIS, under the meeting section, you can see those. And hopefully before every meeting that we have, because you will be voting on things, make sure you look at the meeting materials, the agenda, and review things, because we try to keep things moving really quickly here. So with that said,
Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2017.
Rep. Stark moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2017. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, are all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the motion passes, the rules are adopted. And we're gonna close the organizational meeting, and we will now open an informational meeting with agency overviews. So I just wanna make the point here that we have several new members to the legislative body, and 6 out of 9 people here are actually new to this committee. And so before throwing you into a bunch of bills, we set it up to have a couple of days of just informational hearings. And today's is really aimed at getting an overview of the agencies that we oversee. And the biggest ones of those are Department of Human Services and Oregon Housing and Community Services. There are a couple of other agencies that we oversee, Oregon Youth Authority and the Commission on the Blind. There are not big issues that are coming up right now that we foresee on the agenda. If there are issues, then we'll do a brief overview of those agencies before we get into any bills, but we didn't want to do total overload in your first couple days. So today is really just an overview of the agencies. Most of it will be DHS. There's a little piece at the end on Housing and Community Services, and because we can't fit it all in one day, we're spilling over on our next Tuesday to hear more about, not as much the agency, but more about what are just the needs. Not getting so much next time into specific policy suggestions that we'll be dealing with, but just what are the needs out there. So that's how we've organized our first two hearings, and then our third hearing, we'll start hearing bills. So with that, Clyde Psyche, Director of Department of Human Services, and I know you've got your whole team. And again, on the meeting materials in OLIS, you will find this report, and it'll be very helpful. It'll be easy to remember if you ever want to go back, because a lot of this will probably like be overwhelming. It's such a big agency. But because it's on the first day, you can always go back to the agenda on the first day and find this report, or you can download it onto your computer, which I've done, because it's really helpful. It's going to be a lot of information.
Right.
We've divided it up into a general overview, as well as people from different departments, directors of different departments, so that you can put faces to the names of who runs the different departments within DHS. Thank you, Clyde.
Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Sanchez, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to give you an overview of the agency. It is a very large and complex agency, and we would make the offer now that for any of you, if you wanted to spend some additional time outside of committee for us to brief you on any issues or just give you general information, we'd be happy to do so, because we know that with the number of programs we have and the client groups that we serve, it can be a bit overwhelming at times. It's a bit overwhelming for me at times, I would say that. So really, the foundation in the first slide is about our mission and our core values. The mission on the graphic on the right is in the center, and it's safety, health, and independence for all Oregonians. And around that circle are our seven core values, which really guide the way we work with people and the way we provide services. On the left are really what our priorities are as far as the department. And it's really that every Oregon child and youth in our care deserves to grow up safely and have success in school. Every Oregon adult deserves to live in safety, free from abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. Every Oregonian has a right to live as independently as possible with dignity, choice, and self-determination. And really, the choice and self-determination is a really important part of our mission. We want people, as they age, to really be kind of the guide, be able to guide their own destinies, and as much as possible, be as independent as possible and stay in their homes as long as it's humanly possible. And then every Oregonian can work to the best of their abilities to contribute to their family and community. So on the second slide, we provide direct services to more than 1 million Oregonians every year. And this bubble chart or graphic really just gives you an idea of some of the services we provide. And the very top in the middle, I think that's a very important one because hunger is such a big issue in Oregon. But the department provides food benefits to one in every four Oregonians, and hunger continues to be an issue we struggle with in this state. And then to the right of that, the other thing I'd like to highlight is really with the aging of the population of the state of Oregon and the change in demographics, we provide assistance to over 39,000 older adults and people with disabilities with their activities of daily living. And a lot of that support allows them to stay in their home rather than to have them go to a nursing facility or some kind of a care facility. So many of the people who receive service from us actually receive more than one service. In fact, nearly two-thirds of the people we serve receive two or more services. And this slide on the left really is a display of some of the major services we provide, and then a percentage breakdown of how many people receive two, three, four, or five services from the department. And it just goes to show that really, although we have five different programs, there's a lot of overlap between programs. And a individual or consumer or client may be served by more than one of our programs. So the coordination internally among our programs is vitally important. The next slide is really a representation of the impact we have on communities, because 79% of our budget is paid out to local providers and clients, who in turn then reinvest some of that money back into the community. So when you think about a $10.6 billion budget, 79% of that going out to local communities, it makes quite an impact as far as the economy at the local level. Annually, we draw down $3.6 billion of general funds, a lot of that in our self-sufficiency program, in our temporary assistance to needy families, our cash assistance program, and through our SNAP program, what was known as the food stamp program. What's that? Federal funds, yeah. Excuse me, federal funds. Really the rest of the chart is just a display of some of the impact we have. I think the one number that always jumps out at me is that sort of in the middle of the page there, 34,820 local providers whose salaries are paid by the department. And these are people locally who provide services to seniors and people with developmental and intellectual disabilities and a lot of the client groups we serve. So the next slide is really just a real quick view at our organizational structure. We have five major program areas. We have our aging and people with disabilities, which is the green box there. The middle two boxes are central administrative type units with the chief of staff and our public affairs office. We changed our org chart structure, and so I'm kind of mixed up a little bit. But really, the green boxes are our five major program areas: aging and people with disabilities, our Office of Developmental Disability Services, child welfare, self-sufficiency, vocational rehabilitation, and then across to the right of that are sort of the director's office and centralized kind of functions that serve the whole department, like our tribal affairs officer. So our 2015 and 17 legislatively approved budget, just to kind of give you an idea of where the money goes, this is through the September interim ledge days. Our budget's about $10.6 billion for the biennium. We have about 7,900 full-time equivalent employees. 32% of our budget, or about $3.4 billion, goes to our self-sufficiency programs. Those are cash assistance, our 10F programs, employee-related daycare, and our SNAP program, our food stamp program. 30% of our budget goes, or $3.1 billion, goes to services for seniors and people with physical disabilities. This is the one area where, again, due to the change in demographics of the state, we really are projecting growth in that area as the population ages and more people come to us for service. 21% of the budget, or about $2.3 billion, is our department or that serves people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And a lot of times people are surprised by this. 9% of our budget really goes to the child welfare, and a lot of people think it's a lot more than that. 7% is really the administrative part with the shared central services, employee salaries, those types of things. And then 1% of our budget goes to our vocational rehabilitation program. So the next chart, I think, again, just points out kind of where the money is spent. And 96% of our budget really is spent for direct payments and direct services to clients. These are payments to providers, payments to clients, and direct client services. And so as you can see, the majority of our $10.6 billion project really doesn't stay in the department. It goes out and provides services and payments to providers, clients, and the people we serve. So that is kind of a quick overview. I know we have a lot to cover today, so we wanted to, at least in the beginning, keep it at a pretty high level. Let me stop there, and before we bring up our child welfare program, see if anybody has any questions.
Okay, great.
Neglected to introduce Eric Moore, who is our chief financial officer. He's the numbers guy, and so I thought if you had any numbers on the budget, I better have him here just in case.
Great.
So with that, I'd like to bring up Laurie Price, who's our deputy director for our child welfare programs. Let me just stay here. Yeah.
Thank you. And we've allocated a little bit more time to this particular program because it's been of great concern over the last few years. You've probably seen a lot of articles in the newspaper, and I know that our vice chair has worked really hard on this issue and will continue to with many of you. And we've had audits and a variety of things that have really tried to focus in. So although the pie slice was smaller on this, it's consumed a lot of attention and will continue to this session. So a little bit more time for this particular department overview.
Thank you, Chair Genegeier, Vice Chairs Stark and Sanchez, members of the committee. My name is Laurie Price, and I have the pleasure of serving as Deputy Director of Child Welfare Program here in Oregon. As Director Psyche explained, we're going to give a brief overview. I grabbed some numbers I thought you might be interested in. I'll give you just a very few minutes of that, and then I'm here to answer any questions you have to help inform the committee as they move forward. Our mission is keeping children safe at home whenever possible. Providing safe and appropriate placements for children when they can't remain at home, and making certain that older youth that remain in care have opportunities for successful transition to adulthood. our goals and operating principles, and you'll see we have kind of a theme between all of our departments. We're going to go over the same types of information. Our safe and swift response to allegations of abuse, both in and out of care. Safe and appropriate placements for children while they're in the foster care system. Safe and equitable reduction in the number of children who experience foster care. We're expanding program partnerships to increase the cultural competency of DHS staff, providers, and partners to better serve Oregon's diverse communities. We recruit, retain foster families and contracted providers to help keep Oregon's children safe and well cared for while they're in care. And we're pursuing public-private partnerships to best support children and families in Oregon. Our department is organized into three different sections: safety, permanency, and well-being. Under the safety section, you can see that we have our Child Protective Services box. We have differential response, which here in Oregon allows for an alternative response at the front door of entry into our system. And we placed our federal policy planning and resources section in safety for purposes of this discussion, but it's an overarching department that assures that we're meeting federal requirements and that we're drawing down the most federal funding as possible to serve children and families in Oregon. There's the well-being section, which really takes care of kids during the middle of their stay with us, and that's our foster care program is housed in there, treatment services, independent living program, again, for those youth, those older youth that are in our care, the health and wellness program, and then we also have our homeless and runaway youth program that's run out of our well-being section. And then we have permanency, which is kind of the back end of our program. We have our adoption services for those children that cannot go home to their families. The 4E waiver, which allows the state to do something a little bit different with the federal funds. So Title 4E helps offset the cost to the state of foster care for children. Oregon has been a state that's asked for waivers since the middle of the 1990s, and we've asked the federal government to let us do things a little bit differently, to try out new efforts and see if we can improve outcomes for children and families. Today's child or Title 4E waiver program is called LIFE, and it really focuses on those kids that we believe may experience our system for longer than other kids, and we target additional resources. We particularly focus more on intensive family engagement, which is LIFE, leveraging intensive family engagement for those families, in an effort to make sure that those children also have the same ability to return home as all others. We have post-adoption services in that same category to help support our families who do adopt through the system, and Interstate Compact, and that helps with the placement of children outside of our state boundaries and those coming into our state from other states' child welfare systems. Last year, a total of 11,191 children spent at least one day in some type of foster care here in Oregon. On the left hand, the brightest green shows some demographics of what that population looks like. On any single day, we have an average of 7,600 children in foster care in Oregon. 46% of those are placed with relatives. We received 76,668 calls reporting potential abuse or neglect in Oregon. That's a 9.6% increase over the number of calls that we experienced last year. We completed 37,320 investigations during that time period. 748 of Oregon's children were adopted through the child welfare system. 89.7% of those were adopted with their siblings. And 282 exited to guardianship, which is another form of legal permanency for children. We have 3,881 certified foster homes in Oregon, and we have 1,359 youth currently served through our independent living program through the state.
Could you just say the ages for the independent living program?
Ages 14 and up, technically, but primarily we focus on 16 and up.
Up to 25?
Up through 21. They can stay into care up until age 21. Oregon asked for that. States had an option to end services at 18 or to serve up through 21, up until 21.
Yeah.
And so we're able to do that. 46.3% of all of our victims of child abuse in the state were younger than age 6. 83.6% of the kids that come into care because of findings of neglect or threat of harm for neglect. We have three types of care or three levels of care for children that experience foster care. We have family foster care, and those are those family homes that I talked to you about that we go out and we certify, and children are placed in family foster care. We always attempt to place with relatives first. Those relatives are, they experience the same certification process as any other foster family, but we do have an expedited process that allows for quicker placement of children with their relatives while we complete the entire certification process. We have behavioral rehabilitative services here in Oregon, and that takes the shape of either treatment foster care or residential care for children who have extreme behavioral needs. And then there's psychiatric residential care for those that have mental health issues that require additional treatment. System capacity has been a challenge for us here in Oregon. And through November of last year, we had lost, over the course of the 2 years prior, 150 certified family foster homes. We had lost 60 of our contracted behavioral rehabilitation services beds. And there have been 95 psychiatric residential placement beds lost throughout the state. Child Welfare's put a lot of effort into building our system and rebuilding our system. And I can tell you that in December, and it had been through the whole year's worth of work, we were able to bring on 61 new behavioral rehabilitation services beds. So we're evening up there. Representative Stark joined us last Friday for a new public-private partnership with Every Child. They're going to work with us over the next 5 years to build community supports around the recruitment and retention of foster families throughout the state of Oregon. And there are many other initiatives, but I wanted to just let you know why I ended that number at November 16, because we're finally seeing a bit of an upswing. I can tell you that we haven't lost any more foster homes since then, and we're just continuing to build. So with that, I'll stop and ask you if there are any questions or anything that I can speak to specifically that can help inform the committee as you make your really tough decisions moving forward this session.
So, Chair Kinnegar, yep. There's just a couple things I'd like to add, that would be okay with you. So I think one of the reasons I am where I am today is because of the issues we had with the foster care, with the child welfare system, and that when the governor asked me to come in, we had experienced a number of major issues around safety for children. I just want to put it on the record that we have a lot of really heroic and great people out in the community who are doing great work every day. Unfortunately, the media really likes to focus on when things go wrong as opposed to really at times highlighting the great work that's being done. But that being said, there is a lot of room for improvement, and we realize that. One of the things I think we've realized over the past year is that if we think we can do the work and be successful just by ourselves, we're not going to be successful. It really is incumbent on us to reach out to the community, to stakeholders, to providers, and to all join together to really to try to solve the problems. And a lot of the work really needs to be done at the local level, not the state level, because that's where the solutions lie. And we really need to start listening, and that's something we haven't done, because I will tell you right now that our people who are on the ground and the CASA volunteers and the stakeholders and the providers who are working with these children on a daily level, they are the people who know where the problems are, and they are the people who know how to solve the problems that we are facing. So as a department, we have started to change the way we interact with the public, with stakeholders, and the other important piece is we have to actually start listening to our foster parents and our foster kids themselves. For too long, we have not been open to listening to the people who are actually the recipients of the service. So I will tell you, it's been a lot of hard work, and we have a lot of hard work ahead of us. But I think that with the people we have, if we stay at it and we continue down the path we're on, I expect us to be successful over time.
I'm going to ask one overall question and then the others ask, and then I probably have a couple follow-up. But could you also address the audit that was done that raised concerns with the 14 different milestones that we were not able to meet? Could you address some of the highlights
of that? Well, there were two... two major efforts, kind of audits, so to speak, or program reviews. The Governor commissioned an independent study, and we brought in an independent contractor, Public Knowledge, who spent about 6 months. And I think Representative Peluso was part of that steering committee, advisory committee, and really took a deep dive into several areas and came up with a set of recommendations and really shone the spotlight on two particular areas that we were having trouble with, is finding the appropriate placement, safe and appropriate placement for children, and then the way we were responding to calls made to the hotline and our response time and how we responded to concerns that were raised. The second piece was the Federal Child and Family Services Review. Just earlier this week, we received the findings of that review, and while we had some strengths, we actually had a few more areas we had to correct than areas where they deemed for us to have strengths in. And I guess I would share with you is when I kind of look back at the last 5 or 6 years in the department, we've had a lot of studies, reports, audits, and they've consistently, I think, pointed out the same issues over and over again. So it's really not about audits or studying. It's what are we doing as a department to respond to that? And typically, the way we've responded is we have 10 different issues, so we form 10 different committees. The 10 committees go off on their own. They don't report centrally. We don't have a good way of monitoring what the committees are doing. So quite frankly, what happens over time is, in some cases, depending on who heads the committee, we actually get work done and we make improvements. In other times, the committees lose interest, and because nobody's holding them accountable, no work gets done or no improvement is made. So what we've done, I'm a firm believer in the project management methodology because it puts a framework and a discipline around a process. And so we're building a unified project improvement plan, which includes the results of the federal review, the public knowledge review, audits and reviews we've had done over the 5 years. And under the project management methodology, we're going to identify areas we need to improve. We're going to prioritize so we can address the areas that are most critical first. We're going to identify strategies that we need to implement. We're going to assign people who are accountable for implementing these strategies. We're going to assign timelines, and we're also going to assign metrics so we know if we're making progress or not. And then we have one program manager. So if I need to know where we are, I go to one person. I don't have to search out 10 different people. I have one person who's accountable to getting this work done, and he's the person I'm going to go to say, where are we? Are we getting this done? And if we're not, why aren't we getting it done? And I think approaching the way we try to improve in a different way and instilling some discipline and also using metrics to tell us whether or not we're achieving the outcomes, I'm hopeful, or I think that will get us to a better result than we have had in the past.
May I?
Yes.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, I just want to add to that. Everything that Clyde said is true. I just want to add a couple of things just for the committee's knowledge, and that is that when you first read about the department's failure in all of those categories, that was actually the result of a statewide self-assessment. We reviewed ourselves, and we said these are areas where we have not done well. And although I agree with Director Psyche, and I am in full support of the project management philosophy and plan and being able to feed everything into one thing, and I do believe it will drive us to better outcomes, I think it's important for this committee to recognize that just what Director Psyche said, that there are a number of folks that are deeply committed to this work, and that we have suffered a great a lack of resource over the course of time that has certainly played a part into this. So I just wanted to get that on the record as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say, Mr. Director, I really appreciated your comment about local control, local involvement. I really admire that in that statement from you. It shows real leadership to me. I think that's often forgotten in this building by everybody, not by anyone in particular. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be crucial that this committee and that this body focuses heavily on getting past the media pressure of focusing on a bad incident here and there so that we don't overreact and cause unintentional consequences to those actions based on that pressure. Too often, I think, in the political body, we just respond to that pressure with a knee-jerk reaction. I want you to know, me personally, I want to be a resource for you to lean on, to talk to about how I can best help you figure out how we can get that back to the local level, because any of us that think we're godlike enough, which none of us are, to fully understand every issue in every community and actually do something directly about it from Salem specifically and not lean on the people in the local communities is foolishness. And although I'm new to this committee, I'm not new so much to the issues. My community in particular has got a very bad meth epidemic, and unfortunately I'm seeing problems both sides. We're not able always to identify the children quickly enough that do need to be removed, but I'm also seeing sometimes what I perceive to be abuse from the department. And we all know it just takes one or two bad behaviors to make everybody look bad. But there's, I think, failure on both sides of protecting parents and children. And I think we got to give a hard look on how we can best fix that. So I applaud you. Thank you.
So Chair Kindergeier, Vice Chair Stark, and Vice Chair Sanchez and Representative Hurd, thank you very much for that. We really... In the list of the mention that I of people who we need to work with and who we need to support to be successful, I'm sorry I left the legislature out, because in order for us to be successful, we really do have to partner. And I think one of the things we will commit to you is that we will be transparent. If we make a mistake, we'll own that mistake and we'll tell you, and we won't try to hide things from you. And so one of the things I will tell you is that if any of you have a concern or a question, please feel free to reach out to me, and you know, we're in this together.
Thank you. Representative Sanchez.
Madam Chair, thank you. Director Psyche, of course, I've been worked with you all many, many times, and as a member of the Family Services Review Commission, and as a service provider in the Portland metro area, and you know, we've struggled a lot, but I do have to say that I recognize under your leadership that we have made some significant changes and shifts, and I just want to recognize that, and thank you for that, the work that you've done. But I do have a concern of where we are with differential response, and I want to know where, you know, if we're moving forward with that continued implementation. I know we sort of slowed that down a little bit, and I would really like to see that happen, because I think that it will hopefully make some efforts towards reducing the number of kiddos that we have in foster care. And also, of course, continue to have the concern of the disproportionate number of kids of color in the foster care system, in particular Native American kids at 5.2%, given that we're about 1.8% of the entire population. That would say we're all close to 3 to 4 times represented more in that system than we should be. And you know, needless to say, the issues of neglect and threat of harm or neglect is that large number. And, you know, I have, of course, known in my work for many, many years doing this, that oftentimes that issue is about poverty. So I'd like to just, you know, ask you that question about where we're going with differential response, and what can we do about that other issue from your perspective. Sure. I mean, I know what we can do about it larger.
So thank you, Vice Chair. And please, before you answer, describe differential response briefly.
Okay. So, Chair Kindergeier, Representative Stark, and Representative Sanchez, I'm going to let Ms. Price describe differential response to you. But I do want to say that under our child welfare director, and our child welfare director, Lena Al-Husseini, isn't with us because she's really at the Casey Foundation, has a national forum for child welfare leaders. It's actually more of a national
Child Welfare Director trainee, and we thought it was very important for her to get engaged with that, and especially on the national level. But Ms. El-Husseini and Ms. Price announced last week that we are reinstating and beginning to move forward with implementation of differential response. So to your other question.
Well, just and differential response, as I understand it, is the strategy of when children are at risk for being put in the child welfare system, that there's a series of family supports that are put in place before they get actually fall into the system. So it's a
determination.
Oh, okay. I thought you were moving on.
No.
Okay.
No.
We'll see how close I was to being right.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Rep Stark, and Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. Differential response does allow for an alternative response when it's safe to do so. So the same safety assessment is done on a family. But as I mentioned to you, such a high number of cases for us are neglect or threat of harm for neglect that many of those children can remain safely at home with the right supports put around them. And I don't know that I shared that number with you, but we had 6,066 children served at home last year. Did I share that? I wrote it down. Sorry about that. Differential response allows for an alternative response. It really what has enabled us to move to this, because we don't have a lot of, we have very little prevention funding from the federal government. It's been Senate Bill 964, the Strengthening, Preserving, Reunifying Families, that allowed us to build these service arrays in local communities. And the service arrays are what allow us, that plus community services, allow us to the services to wrap around the family. So we identify specifically what that family needs. We wrap services around that family in an effort to keep the child safely at home. Director Psyche mentioned that there was a note that came out earlier this week from Director El-Husseini speaking about differential response. So I can tell you where we're at with that. We were holding on, waiting for the first outcomes report to come from our evaluator, which is University of Illinois. We got the first outcomes report. We brought the steering committee back together. They made recommendations about how they'd like to see us move forward. There are a couple of steering committees being formed right now because there were some issues that were brought up around our initial implementation. We want to be sure that we get it right. We want to make whatever small adjustments. It's all part of that implementation science. You kind of move with programs and you learn from what you're doing. So we've got a couple of adjustments we want to make to the program, and then we're going to bring people back together and we'll be thoughtfully moving forward with what those recommendations bring to us.
So do you want me to finish
my answer?
How do you guys want to do this?
Yep.
So Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez, on the issue of racial disparity, we do a lot of work around the Indian Child Welfare Act with the tribes, but primarily in the past our work has been centered around child welfare specifically. We have started meeting with the tribal human services directors on a quarterly basis because we realize that support we can provide in our other programs, especially our poverty programs on the self-sufficiency side, will really lead to better outcomes for Indian children. And so we've had a couple of meetings so far. We're meeting with them. We have our program people meeting with certain tribes offline. And really that's kind of what our goal is not just to focus on Indian child welfare with the tribes, but really look at the whole array of services we provide and how can we support tribes or allow tribes to run the programs when applicable themselves, or really increase services, because we believe it'll all have a direct impact in the end on the child welfare system.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. On the DR, the report that came out, are you guys, or can you please make that available on OLIS to the committee? I would like to see that report. I thought originally that that report would be coming to us. I have some concerns about differential response. I love the concept of it. I absolutely love the concept. Some of my concerns around it have been hearing from local branches that it has been so time-consuming that they've dropped off other services. And that, if you go back to the origins of it, that, you know, we provided staff and resources to make sure that didn't happen. And then on the local front as well, some agency individuals questioning the effectiveness. So I really want to see the results of what's actually happened. I'm interested in seeing the numbers. If they're not in there, maybe you can get those to us on, you know, all those children that we did the alternative response versus the traditional response.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see how many of those who began on alternative still eventually ended up transitioning to a traditional response. Because those are some important numbers. If we're intervening and it, all it's doing is prolonging something, you know. So anyway, I'd really like to dive into that issue. Not that we have to go into all that today, but I'd like to see that report.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Stark, members of the committee, the those are really good questions that you've got around that, and those are some of the things. And you'll see as you look at the outcomes report. I'd like to also be able to share with this committee what the work groups are that are going to target some of the issues that, that may be feeding into that.
So that's great. I'm going to hold off on, I'll just mention my question, but don't answer, because I want to make sure we have time for the others. You mentioned that there's a 9.6 increase in calls from last year. So at some point, I'd love to understand more. I have heard that the housing crunch has created a lot of toxic stress and actual displacement that has contributed to that. But that's probably more anecdotal than it is by the numbers. So I'd love to hear more about that later. Also, I was going to ask for the same thing. If you could put on OLIS for today, because people are going to remember this issue being discussed today, the governor's review, as well as the federal child and family services review, as well as your project management plan, if that's a written document that can be put at this point.
Sure.
Those three documents, I think, would be really helpful. On OLIS, especially because we're going to, the first set of bills that we're going to hear on February 9th is on foster care, so that'll give you a chance if you have the time to review that and see to what extent the policy options that we're going to be considering might reflect some of the challenges that we have.
Yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chairs Stark and Sanchez, members of the committee, we do not have the final report yet from the Child and Family Services Review.
Okay.
But as soon as we have it, we will post it.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll post the other things.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ms. Price.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And next we have Ashley Carson Cottingham with Aging and People with Disabilities. Director of Aging and People with Disabilities.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez. I'm Ashley Carson Cottingham, the Director for Aging and People with Disabilities at the Department of Human Services. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and address you today to start talking about our program. Our mission at Aging and People with Disabilities, we also call ourselves APD a lot, so I apologize if I fall into that habit of saying APD, is that we want to ensure that Oregonians, older adults, and people with disabilities have access to the services and supports that they need to remain healthy, independent, and safe. And we have our offices across the state where Oregonians can go to access those services, and we also deliver services through our Area Agency on Aging partners. The next slide is our goals, and these are our programmatic goals. Throughout the last year, we've gone through a process to establish some of them and reaffirm others. We're also going through the process of aligning these programmatic goals to our quarterly business review metrics, and that will help me be able to come talk about where we're making progress or where we need to work harder, and I'll be able to share that information with you over time. With our system, we have a social model of services. So we start with a holistic assessment of the person. We do strengths-based service planning. And throughout that, we honor choice. Choice is very important in the aging and people with disabilities arena. We also honor dignity and self-direction for our consumers. We balance all of that with natural supports that an older adult or person with disabilities has, and then we work to provide the appropriate services that we can offer to those individuals and their families. So this slide illustrates who we serve. We are able to serve 68,000 Oregonians through the Aging and Disability Resource Connection. This is a service that's offered throughout the state where any Oregonian can call if you have a question or concern for yourself or for your parent or grandparent or spouse, and get all kinds of information through an options counseling process to see what you may be eligible for, what kind of supports there are in your community, learn about different facilities, and that's even if you just need a little bit of support to remain independent or you need to explore more extensive support like a memory care community. We serve 360,000 Oregonians through the Older Americans Act program and Oregon Project Independence, and those services are administered through the Area Agencies on Aging. The Older Americans Act funding is federal funding, and the most well-known program that flows from that law is the Meals on Wheels program, but that federal law also provides other supports to senior centers and provides congregate meals at the senior centers, those types of things. In our offices, we determine financial eligibility for Medicaid for older adults and people with disabilities and SNAP for older adults. And we've served 163,000 Oregonians through our financial eligibility process. We serve many Oregonians, as Director Psyche mentioned, through our Medicaid long-term care program. So the 17,000 number we're extremely proud of. We're able to serve 17,000 Oregonians who need nursing home level of service in their own homes. 12,000 in assisted living, residential care, and adult foster homes, and 4,000 in nursing facilities. And it's important to point out that Oregon has done a lot of transitioning of individuals from nursing facilities, which are considered institutions, out into community-based care and into and being able to provide services in people's homes. And right now, we are still number one in the nation at those effective transitions from nursing homes to community-based settings. We also conduct adult protective services investigations through our offices and the Area Agencies on Aging. And so that 13,000 number represents how many investigations are done. And that's both in the community for our population and in those facilities that I mentioned earlier. And then we do the licensure for over 2,000 total facilities, and that includes all of them, so the adult foster homes, residential care, assisted living, nursing facilities, and many of those have a memory care endorsement on top of that underlying licensure. So our staff are out there in the facilities. Oregon is following all of the national trends. Our population of older adults is expected to increase in Oregon from 500,000 to 950,000 by 2030. The need is increasing dramatically, and it's not expected to stop for quite some time. And so I'm really looking forward to working with all of you to make sure that we're doing everything we can to meet the needs of older Oregonians and Oregonians with disabilities. Thanks so much for your time.
Great. Any questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you. Chair Kennegeier. On Project Independence, I hear all kinds of good stuff about that locally. Can you give us just a couple things of what that allows seniors to do in their own home with that project?
Chair Kennegeier, Vice Chair Stark, thank you for the question. Oregon Project Independence is a wonderful program that is just a state general fund program that kind of, I view it as a big supplement to that Older Americans Act funding that we get from the federal government. And it really allows kind of light touch support for people to stay in their own homes. And so it's similar to Older Americans Act where you get support with meals. You might get a little bit of personal support if you need help with mobility, you know, getting in and out of bed, or you need assistance with bathing, some of those services just so you can stay independent for as long as possible. And it's for the non-Medicaid population. So it's an extremely valuable program, and I think the intent originally is really to try to help give people a little bit of support so that they don't have to come on to the Medicaid program.
And just another note about that, they did a, you've done a pilot project to reach out beyond seniors to people with disabilities with that program. Is that right?
Chair Kiney-Geyer, yes, that is correct. There was a pilot program funded to expand to adults with disabilities, and that was funded, I believe, the biennium before last and then extended into this current biennium. And so we've been able to, through the Area Agencies on Aging, serve that population as well.
Okay. So just to highlight, this is Vice Chair Stark and I have been concerned because it's a very popular, effective program, and it's one slated to be cut back dramatically in all of the budgets that are out there at this point. And we encourage you to learn more about this program because it's a really valuable program. Very concerned. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Question about the OPI. So, of course, I do know what it is and really amazing program. I'm very concerned about it. Do you know if there are other states who do something similar to our OPI program and just have any idea of how that works anyplace else? I'm just thinking that it would be helpful for people to know how unique it is, how very helpful it is to folks so that they don't slip below that mm-hmm. that line and end up losing their homes or losing their you know, their ability to live independently is just amazing. And I think well, I know we're time constrained on time, but I really think it is very, very important for people to have a clearer understanding of what that looks like, you know, not just here in Oregon, but how it makes sense on a larger level for folks to be able to live independently and just have that minor help for short periods of time, oftentimes, until they're able to be back on their feet. We have many clients out of our programs who've received those services and are so very grateful for that opportunity to not have to go into nursing homes.
Chair Kiney-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, pardon me, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez, thank you for the question. I do not know off the top of my head if other states have as robust of a supplementary program as Oregon Project Independence. I'm really proud of that program, but I'd be happy to do some research and find out what other states have. What I will say is the Older Americans Act funding is small,
yeah.
And so it's exciting that Oregon has had this extra funding to be able to provide people those critical supports. And I'll add that we can also provide snapshots of individuals being served in your different areas by this program, because I think it's good to see, you know, what is the profile of a person receiving Oregon Project Independence support. So I'm happy to find those profiles and bring them forth if you'd find that useful.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
That'd be great. Yes.
Madam Chair, this may be a question for Director Psyche. Related to the budget, I see that the aged and physically disabled budget was like $3.1 billion. Does any of that money or funds include federal funds? Because I see that the one of the programs, the Aging Disability Act, was federally funded, but then OPI is state funded. And that the budget you provided us a little bit ago, it was that just general funds budget?
Yes. Yeah. Chair Kiney-Geyer, Representative Stark, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Representative Meek, it's a total funds budget, the graph we showed you. So it's a combination of other general and federal.
Okay, that's good. That's what I was trying to, because it said legislatively approved budget, but there are some programs, Medicaid, et cetera, that supplement all the programs.
Sure.
Correct.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's a total funds budget.
Great. Vice Chair Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kiney-Geyer. Ashley, on you know our involvement on this upcoming question. When it comes to licensing and long-term care facilities, at my town hall last week, I had 30 plus constituents that came out to talk about frustrations with just really trying to understand the regulations and the rules that we have in place. Do we, and I know we've talked about this a lot, Lily, on the IDD side, for the adult side, do we have kind of a simplistic flyer that lays out, you know, here's our primary regulations and rules that have to be met, and then here's the frequency that you would expect audits or visits in there, timelines on, you know, how to respond and when to respond by, and when to expect a response to the response. I mean, I'm trying to come up with something that, you know, we can help some of these providers just know how to navigate the system, because it is very complex.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez, thank you for the question, Rep. Stark. So as far as a simplistic flyer, I don't think that exists right now, but I appreciate the question. I think we have struggled with ensuring that some of our providers who are adult foster home providers, some of our most valued providers, are doing excellent work, but we've had some that have struggled, and our licensure for those providers sits out in the community. And so I think we've struggled with some gaps in communication with those frontline licensors and the folks here in Salem. And so we're trying to iron out make those lines of communication really open and clear. But I would be happy to start working on a communication that would help the adult foster home providers really understand the expectations. The rules are pretty extensive. We do expect a lot of providers of long-term care, because they're caring for people who are extremely vulnerable. And so the rules that we expect to be followed are extensive and sometimes complicated. And so our goal is to really make sure that we're providing technical assistance, that we're being clear and transparent. I know that hasn't always occurred, and I'll continue to improve and work with my team to improve, but they are working incredibly hard, and they are, you know, they want to make sure that consumers are being served in the best way possible, and that we're supporting the providers, because without those two things, our system falls apart.
Thank you, Chair. And so if I were to focus my question a little more, or my request would be less on, as far as the simplistic timeline or flyer, to really focus on when the frequency of audits, when someone's out, the responses, and when they expect to hear back, you know, just that. Mm-hmm. Once there's something that has to be fixed, how do they navigate that, and what sort of timeline do they expect? If I were to set you out and say, can you focus on this part, that's where I'd ask you to do.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark. So they can expect their annual sort of inspection. It's once a year. And we go in more frequently if there have been problems in the foster home, or we've had allegations of abuse, or a case manager, if it's a Medicaid consumer living in a foster home, has seen something that's slightly off. Then we would have our licensing folks in there more frequently. So those are kind of the triggers for being in the home more often. But as far as the communication expectations for when they can have results of the findings, I would be happy to provide clearer information on that.
Thanks.
That's great. And in addition to some of the budget questions that we'll be looking at, and hopefully making some recommendations to the subcommittee for programs that this committee feels are really important, we are going to be looking at kind of regulations and licensing for some of the long-term care facilities. This committee heard some testimony last year about memory care in particular that was very alarming. And a lot of the groups that provide this care are doing a great job, and there are some that are not. And these are some of our most vulnerable citizens. And so as a result of that hearing and a bill that had been brought forth last year, it didn't go anywhere. It was a five-week session. There's been a lot of work since then, and you will be hearing some of the concepts in this committee. So I know that some of those have originated with advocates in the community, some originated with the department itself, some have originated with the representatives of the industry, the Oregon Healthcare Association. It's been a lot of work. There's a Purple Ribbon Commission that's working on it. So that will be one of the focuses of our committee work as well. So thank you. Ashley.
Thank you.
Okay, great. And next we have Lilia Tenenti. Tenenti? And I slip into being very informal, and I use first names a lot. I hope that is okay. Welcome.
Welcome. Good morning. My name is Lilia Tenenti. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services in the Department of Human Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come today and talk about our programs and the people we support and the types of services we provide. The mission for the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Services Program is that Oregon's system of supports is simple to use and responsive to the strengths, needs, and direction of the people and families who live as valued members of their community. This statement was developed in partnership with a group of stakeholders representing all areas of our system about 2 years ago now. And so we continue to use it and focus on it and try to move in the direction of making our services responsive and honestly simple to use, which continues to be a challenge for us in a number of different areas. But that is our goal and where we are headed. Our operating principles came to us from a Senate bill, actually, that was a collective process about what it was that Oregon valued for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. This is around the time that the state was moving into the Community First Choice Option, or K-Plan, and this became a really important discussion for our stakeholders and for the office itself. Our primary operating principles are safety, health, and welfare. We're really focused, as is the rest of DHS, on what we can do to shore up and ensure that the people who are living in our system and receiving services through our provider agencies are safe and healthy. Right now, our focus in that direction for this system is really looking at our direct care workforce and the workforce of our provider agencies and what we're seeing happen there as a result of funding levels for wages and other issues. So that's one that I expect we'll be talking a lot about and hearing more about over the course of this session. We really value in our system choice and self-determination. This is a long-standing core value for intellectual and developmental disability services systems. We have an individual support planning process that occurs on an annual basis with an individual, their family, and any provider or other individual they would like to bring to the table for that discussion. In Oregon, we're a leader in integrating individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities into their communities. Oregon was one of the first states to close all of its institutional settings for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So our system does not have any state-run or privately-run institutions for this population. That's something that is a strong core value of this system and of our community, and we continue to focus on that as we move forward in other areas consistent with integrating people into the local community, like our work around integrated employment and the Employment First Initiative. Our services, we also want those to be consistent with choice, and we want individuals and families and advocates to play a major role in the services we provide. As I mentioned earlier, we work a lot with our stakeholder community. They have a vocal voice at the table. We are I will say always engaged with stakeholders on any number of issues surrounding how we can better support individuals, children, and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities in our system. We also strongly support integration, independence, and productivity tied to helping people be productive members of their community, as well as engaging community activities and accessing not only supports from us, but the natural supports that may occur that many of us also appreciate, like having a friend help us with something or being involved in a church group that helps us with something and things of that nature. The people we serve, first off, in our program, we serve both children and adults. So any child or adult who's diagnosed with intellectual or developmental disability is usually served through the Office of Developmental Disabilities in the state of Oregon. We serve, at this point, about 1,800 adults and 7,500 children. It's worth noting that the number of children we've served has increased significantly as a result of implementation of the Community First Choice option, or K-Plan. We're providing a much more robust array of services to children and who live with their families in in-home services. And that's something that I think has been a positive of moving toward the Community First Choice or K option. We talk about intellectual and developmental disabilities. Our eligibility criteria covers both. Intellectual disabilities are generally defined as someone with an IQ that falls below 70 to 75 range, and those individuals also then have a limited ability to complete the things that they need to do in their daily lives. Developmental disabilities are conditions like autism, autism spectrum disorders, Down syndrome, and cerebral palsy. So as you think about the population we serve, these are the criteria we use to determine eligibility for our program, both for children and adults. Our front door, our program is a little bit different than other DHS programs. Our front door is community developmental disability programs, which are either government county entities or contracted entities that we work with throughout the state that serve as the front door for DD services. They do eligibility, and they also do our protective service investigations, and then they offer case management once someone is fully in services. In addition to the CDDPs that offer case management, we also have brokerages throughout the state that offer case management to people who live in in-home settings. So we've got two options for people in in-home settings around case management, and our front door are these community partners that we have. It's not something that we do with state staff. Types of services we provide: in-home services is our most popular service. It's the one that most people access because a large number of folks, adults and children, live with families, even as adults. And so we have provide in-home services for people to come into a home, help a person with cooking, help them do chores or cleaning, but then also help them go out and do grocery shopping or access their community the way everyone else does who may not need that level of support. We have residential services, group homes, community provider agency group homes. We also have adult foster care. We have about 2,800 adults in each of those types of settings, 28 in group homes and about 2,800 in foster care settings at this point. We have a small number of children's residential settings. We are looking to expand the number of children's group homes we have. That has been, as you heard from child welfare, similar in the DD system. We've got some issues with capacity there, and we're working to try to encourage providers to help us in that area. We also have a state-run stabilization and crisis unit. This is this unit runs under the same group home rules and regulations as our community providers. It's there to provide supports to, at this point, where we're at is it's where the people that we find in our system with the most significant behavioral needs, we provide this option for them. We have about 90 to 100 people in those settings on any given day, usually about 10 kids. We have 10 children, and about the rest are adults, 89 to 90 adults in those settings. I'll talk a little bit about employment services as well. We have a wide array of employment services. We're partnering with Vocational Rehab right now in the Office of the Oregon Department of Education, ODE, to move forward on our Employment First initiative, where we're really focused on helping individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities access integrated jobs in the community with support through vocational rehab, with support through the Department of Education as they are transitioning from high school or transition programs into adulthood, and then through the Department of Developmental Disabilities, we provide an array of Medicaid-funded services for people to learn about jobs that they might want, to learn about working, and then once they have a job through VR, to continue the long-term support for the person in the job through the DD program. That initiative was started in 2008 and also has a lawsuit settlement agreement focused on it. The Lane settlement agreement is something we're working on. And then there are a number of federal regulations for each of our different systems that are also pointing us in the direction of supporting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to access integrated jobs in their community. I'd be happy to take, yes, that is my last slide. I'd be happy to take questions at this point.
Madam Chair, just a quick question. Thank you for the work. And I had a question related to the employment services. I know that, you know, it's part of a fundamental, you know, well-being to feel like you're appreciated and you have some kind of work to do. One of my, the services in my community is called Exceed Enterprises. Is that on? My question is related to that. Are there any other programs like that around the state that are offering employment services?
Chair Kinigeyer, Vice Chair Stark, and Sanchez, and Representative Meek, I am going to say I can verify that, but Exceed Enterprises, if I'm remembering correctly, I'm hesitant to say yes exactly because I want to be sure I understand exactly what they provide from memory. Mm-hmm. But in general, we have employment-type services offered statewide, whether it's job coaching, whether it's something we call employment path. And I'll go back and verify exactly what services this agency provides, and then I can provide you a list of similar agencies.
Yeah, Exceed Enterprises is... they help manufacture or package goods for like a lot of large, you know, Intel, yeah. Nike, et cetera. But they're pretty streamlined. They have different. It's a big warehouse type of setting, but it's a great, fantastic model, and they do quality control, lots of different things. But I was just wondering if there's any other programs like that.
What you're describing and what I recall that I would quantify this as for our system is a sheltered workshop setting, and that is something that we do have in other parts of the state. Our Employment First Initiative and the Lane lawsuit settlement are really focused on helping the individuals who work in those settings transition to competitive integrated jobs in the community. I'd be glad to come and talk to you about everything that we, you know, have done related to this and how we're supporting not only provider agencies with transformation grants and technical assistance, but also the work we're doing to help people learn about their opportunities. I'd be glad to do that.
Great work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. That was great. That was a really great overview.
Well, only because.
Okay.
Because it's, we're starting to run out of time because we have such a great engaged committee. That's fabulous. Thank you, Lilia. And so Kim Fredland, Director of Self-Sufficiency Programs.
Good morning, Chair Kinigeyer and members of the committee. My name is Kim Fredland, and I'm the Self-Sufficiency Director. Sorry about the mix-up. I thought I was going to go after.
Actually, that would make sense, too. We just have just following the order here. So, if you want to switch, you can.
No, it's good.
Okay, go for it.
I'm ready.
Good.
So over the last few years, the self-sufficiency programs have gone through what I would say is a bit of a transformation. Through the recession years, there was such need in Oregon for families coming in seeking services around poverty that really we were only being able to provide the safety net in Oregon. So through the transformation, one of the things that has happened is that we've refocused all of our efforts on really all of the things needed to reduce poverty in Oregon. And so we have a new mission statement that really reflects the three key things that we're responsible for in Oregon. And that is to provide the safety net for families that are experiencing a financial crisis, to help with family stability, to kind of stabilize whatever that crisis is that brought them to us. And then probably one of the most important is that connection to careers that guide families out of poverty. So we do this really through five operating principles. The first is family engagement. This is really about helping families achieve their goals as they define them. And really partnering with them to make sure that they're in the driver's seat of really making a plan that's going to work for the family. The second is economic stability, and that's really everything from providing that safety net again to helping with wage progression and helping individuals who are in what's called the working poor really get a better job or a higher paying job. Integrity and stewardship. We're entrusted with a lot of resources, public resources, in order to do this work. And so we want to make sure that we're spending every dollar as it was intended and that we're really investing in things that get the outcomes for families that are really that you all want us to get. Collective impact. Poverty is an issue that's been around, I don't know, maybe forever. And if we really hope to reduce poverty in Oregon, this has to be something that's done with communities. It has to be a collective effort for all of us to work together to really knit all those services together that individuals and families need. And then the last one is professional development. What I like to say to staff is that if I'm expecting you to use the most cutting edge methods and resources or cutting edge methods and techniques, which I am, then I need to give you those skills and tools in order to do that with families. So the Oregonians we serve, because we serve a wide variety of services, we have about, over a year's period of time, we serve almost 800,000 Oregonians with food benefits, and in any given month, that equates to about 300,000 families. We also have our cash assistance, which we serve about 21,000 families with cash assistance. So this is families that really have very little to no income at all. Also, we do provide services to refugees who have newly arrived into Oregon. Our employment and training services, we have two types of employment and training services. One is through the TANF program, which is called JOBS, and the other is through our SNAP or food benefit program. And so we've served a little over 60,000 people during the last year with employment and training services. We also have nutrition education, which over a year's period of time, we've served about 500,000 people with nutrition education, and that's done through partnership. Child care assistance, this is really for families who are working and who are low income, and we help pay a subsidy to help pay a portion of that child care. And then domestic violence services. This is really about helping individuals who are experiencing violence in their home get into a safe situation. So I was trying to be quick so that if you have questions.
Chair, I'm sorry. To...
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a quick question for the child care funding. Do you think you're funded well enough for that? Because I know I've heard that you have no need.
Now there's the question.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for the question because no, there's absolutely not enough. We actually are only serving, we estimate about 18% of the need. You know, when you look at the amount of working families that are really low income, many more of them could receive services through this program. The way the program is funded is it's really a budget neutral program. So they set the budget and then we manage the caseload to that budget.
Who sets the budget?
It's really a combination of federal funds and you all.
Well, I'll put in my pitch now because to me the only way we can get folks out of poverty is to and the biggest barrier to getting into the workforce is childcare for the younger families.
Yeah.
And so, I'm a big advocate of helping folks get out of the poverty cycle. So, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. This was a really big focus last time around, both reforming TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, which our two vice chairs took a big lead in. Carla Peluso was the vice chair last year, and Representative Stark. And the other area that we did significant work last year was the child care program, which is known as ERDC, Employment-Related Daycare. So we can go into greater detail about that later. We did a lot of great work last time. I think funding is, we did a lot of policy work on it, which we can talk about later. Budget remains a huge challenge. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Okay. And then Trina Lee, Director of Vocational Rehabilitation. And sorry that you're getting less and less time as you go through.
That's okay. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Stark and Sanchez. My name is Trina Lee, and I am the Director for Vocational Rehabilitation, and so I'm going to quickly go over our mission, our goals, our objectives, and the services that we provide.
So first and foremost, our mission for vocational rehabilitation, we assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve, maintain, and advance in employment and independence. And I emphasize advance because this is a new directive for us. The Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which is the reauthorization of the Rehab Act, really forces states to really focus upon maintaining employment for individuals with disabilities. And just to kind of put things in perspective, in the state of Oregon, we have over 300,000 Oregonians who experience a disability of working age. That's important because I'll show you the individuals that we serve every year. So flipping over to our goals and objectives, I've been in this chair for a couple of years now, and when I first came in, and really had a chance to take a look at the work, the valuable work that VR has been doing, we have we really wanted to focus our energies. And so we came up with these goals and objectives, and the top three are more externally facing, and I'm going to go through them with you. Implement inclusive dynamic statewide youth programs, and then the second is creating and implement a business engagement model. And then finally, as our final external, is continue to support our customer experience. We want to make sure that it's empowering, effective, and very efficient. And then the last five are more internally focusing upon managing our changes, making sure that we have an agile and sustainable program, that our policy is aligned and consistent, applied through our state, and that we really emphasize that our staff understand our program goals and that they can see how their efforts maximize it. And I'm going to be quick because I'm going to get us back on time. So the Oregonians we serve, and remember, there's over 300,000 Oregonians with disabilities of working age in Oregon. In the last federal fiscal year, we served a little over 16,000 Oregonians. Now you're thinking, wait a minute, if I look at all those boxes, they add up to more than 16,000, and I will explain that. So we have three different types of services that we provide, and I'm going to start with the most intensive, which is supported employment. And we served individuals a little over 2,000 supported employment cases, and that's for at various stages. It doesn't mean that we closed that number of individuals, but we might be actively working with them. We also have a youth transition program, and we serve youth down to the age of 16, but we can serve down to the age of 14 with WIOA if it's appropriate. And then, of course, our basic services for other individuals. And our services are very broad, and it's very person-centric, so it depends upon what the person may need. It may be something from an adjustment to their workstation, to education, it could be a whole array of services. The final box over on the right, independent living, I want to highlight that we funnel the federal dollars to the Centers for Independent Living and the State Independent Living Council across the state. And so these are the individuals that were served, which was over 18,000 last year, who came in for a variety of service. Could be that they were needing some information and referral. It could be that they were using a lending library, working on learning about self-advocacy, those kind of things. So all in all, even though we represent 1% of the of the budget, as Director Psyche had indicated, we do have a pretty large look across the state. We have about 235 staff across the state to provide these services. So I will pause, told you I was going to be quick, and see if you have any questions. Can I highlight one more thing? The picture up on the very beginning under the mission, those are actual individual consumers. We have our State Rehabilitation Council annual report that's coming out next week, and so it highlights stories all across the state. So each one of you, I'll be bringing this to you in the very near future. So
that's great.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, I think that wraps up DHS. I do want to say to Clyde Psyche, this is the third director we've had in about as many years since I've been on this committee. There's been a lot of turmoil and transition, but I've really appreciated his leadership and transparency about the kind of issues that the program has been facing. Did you want to say something?
Well, just a real quick question for Director Psyche.
Sure.
How many DHS employees do we have?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Stark and Sanchez. It varies typically between about 7,900 and 8,180.
That's close enough. I just was astonished when I learned that number, and we are still not able to serve at the level we would like to serve, but the number of employees that make all these good things happen for us, they need to be acknowledged and recognized for some really, really rough times and very good work.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Noble.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Director Psyche, I just want to say that most of my interaction with DHS and law enforcement has been with child welfare and then seniors and with adults with disabilities. And I think sometimes what's lost is all the good that's been done over the years. So I commend you for the direction you're going. And working in Benton County and Yamhill County, I've had the chance to experience the local the work that your staff has done, and very much appreciate that. But again, there's a lot of work to be done, and I appreciate your leadership and the direction and vision you have.
Thank you, Representative.
That's great. Thank you very much. Thank you. We only have 10 minutes left for the Director of Housing Community Services, but fortunately, you are also scheduled to kick us off on Tuesday. So see what you can do in a short amount of time, and then we'll have you start off next time.
Great. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark and Sanchez, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. As you may know, I'm a very new director. I started in this position back in November, so this is my first legislative session working with all of you, and I look forward to working with the committee. In the brief time I have today, I will cover everything you need to know about the complex issue of housing and affordable housing. 9 minutes will do it for us. But in all seriousness, I'll do my best to give you at least an overview of our agency and our broad programs, and then perhaps we can pick up the details when we convene next week.
Yeah.
So getting started, to give us a little bit of background about Oregon Housing and Community Services, the Housing Division of the Department of Commerce was created in 1971, and the Freestanding Housing Finance Agency was created in 1987. Housing finance agencies exist in all states throughout the nation, and across the nation, housing finance agencies work to issue federal tax-exempt bonds, to issue federal low-income housing tax credits, to administer various HUD grants and other federal grants, and also to administer hardest hit funds from the U.S. Treasury, which is a large program through the Treasury Department. Here in Oregon, the community services work was incorporated in 1991, and our role over time has evolved over time so that we also administer various entitlement grants, and those are community service dollars that go to community action agencies around the state, state-funded financing tools, as well as the HUD Section 8 project-based rental assistance administration, and that's the work that we do to provide rental assistance to affordable housing across the state. For a little bit of context on our budget, our agency is primarily funded through other funds, which includes bond funds, bond authority, but we do receive 2% of our funds from state general funds, and 18% of our funds are directly from the federal government and federal grants. To give you a sense of our overall vision and mission, our vision is that all Oregonians have the opportunity to pursue prosperity and to live free from poverty. And our mission is to provide stable and affordable housing and to engage leaders to develop integrated statewide policy that addresses poverty and provides opportunity for all Oregonians. We wanted to give you a little bit of context of the way we see housing as part of our broader community services and anti-poverty work. So for us, housing is the foundation. As we've heard, certainly the discussion earlier today with the DHS folks, you know, certainly folks being housed is a very important place to start for folks to be able to focus on health outcomes, safety, education, and economic opportunity. And what we've found through our work is that providing that roof over a family's head is a great place to start to be able to focus on those additional goals. In order to achieve that, we work across programs with our agency partners at the state and federal level to look beyond just the housing issue at broader economic and poverty issues. And the hopeful outcome there is equity, fiscal sustainability, and the opportunity for prosperity. So a little bit about our agency. We have two main sides of our house in the programs that we administer. The first is housing finance, and that's really focusing on that housing foundation, financing the development and preservation of affordable rental housing, as well as financing home ownership opportunities and down payment assistance and foreclosure avoidance throughout the state as well. And then the second side of the house, which is where I'll start, is housing stabilization. And these are all sort of the anti-poverty programs and the work that we do to work with communities community action agencies around the state to look at the broader set of community solutions for families and individuals. I do want to take a moment to acknowledge the Secretary of State performance audit of our agency. I spoke about this when I came before this committee back in December. As you may be aware, there was a performance audit of our agency from the Secretary of State last year. It provided some tough but very helpful feedback about the challenges our agency faces and the things that we need to do to move our agency forward. And some of the key areas of focus for that audit was on affordable housing preservation as well as agency operations. And the roadmap that we have ahead that the audit lays out for us, which is very helpful, is that we need to focus on shoring up our data and technology systems so that we have a good, keen understanding of our affordable housing portfolio, our risks, our challenges, and our opportunities with our affordable housing, as well as really realizing our vision of becoming a data and research-driven agency so that we have the data in front of us to make informed and strategic decisions about where to invest our dollars, and that we need to focus on a broader statewide housing plan and strategic plan that will lay a roadmap for multi-year investments and strategies so that we know we're making the wisest investments with our funds and best understand the needs of the state. And then finally, the audit really called out our need to do a better job of communication and transparency, both within our agency, working with our staff and managers, with our Housing Stability Council and the governance of that body, as well as with our many stakeholders and partners across the state. So we're putting in actions to address all of those issues, and I'd be glad to answer questions if folks have those. So what I'd like to do today in the few minutes that I have is start with our housing stabilization programs. I'll start with the stabilization side of the house, and I just wanted to feature a few of our key programs. So I'll talk about homelessness prevention, the individual development account program, energy assistance, and weatherization, just to give you an orientation to the great work that we're doing in those arenas. So for homelessness prevention, our programs assist low or very low-income people who are homeless or at risk of becoming homeless. And some of the key funding sources are state funding sources: the Emergency Housing Assistance Program, the State Homeless Assistance Program, the Low-Income Rental Housing Fund, the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, and then the Federal Emergency Solutions Grant Program. So through these programs, we've served more than 16,000 unduplicated homeless or at risk of homeless households during fiscal year 2015 to 2016. And looking forward, I would say our agency is looking to provide more leadership statewide to the community action agencies and local partners who are tackling homeless issues on the ground level so that we can help pull folks together to come up with innovative solutions and strategies and really help to lead the charge on homelessness. Part of the work that we're doing in that arena is to better integrate housing and healthcare, which is, I know, something of very keen interest to this committee, to think about how we can address the healthcare needs and health outcomes of folks that are experiencing homelessness by getting them into safe and stable housing to be able to address those medical needs. And I wanted to give you an example of the EHA program in action. We have a story here that we'd like to share with you. A woman named Tanya Baker is a single mother of three children. She was released from prison in April 2009 with nowhere to go. 3 weeks after release, she was sent to the Josephine County Jail, where she learned about available resources at UCAN, which is one of the community action agencies we partner with the EHA program. Through UCAN, she was provided with rental assistance that kept her off the street. Her case manager guided her into financial counseling, substance abuse services, and helped her to re-enroll in college classes. And today, Tanya is 8.5 years sober. She's employed full-time as a certified alcohol and drug counselor. She serves on the board for Welcome Home Oregon. She holds an Associate of Applied Science degree, and she has nearly completed a bachelor's program at Southern Oregon University. So this is just one of those stories that shows you how providing that rental assistance to get somebody in a stable place to call home allows them to tackle the broader issues in their lives. And Tanya says, "Today I'm employed full-time and I've worked at the same agency for almost 5 years. I believe that having my basic housing needs met is what helped me build the confidence I needed to achieve the goals that seemed unattainable when I was homeless. I refer my clients that want change in their lives to UCAN for housing because I know that housing stability was the most important thing for me." I'm going to switch gears and talk briefly about the Individual Development Account Program. The Oregon Individual Development Account Program, or IDA, was created in 1999 by the Oregon State Legislature, and it's funded by the Oregon IDA Tax Credit. It is, in fact, the largest IDA initiative in the country, so we should be very proud of that. We have currently more than 3,300 active participants in the program, and last year, more than 1,000 participants graduated from the program. And the way that IDA program works is that it provides a 3-to-1 match savings account and financial education toward defined goals. And the most common goals are education, small business startup, and home ownership. It's a collaboration between our agency, the Department of Revenue, neighborhood partnerships, and local fiduciary organizations. And again, here we wanted to show you an example so you saw how the program works in action. So a participant named Carrie Garfield in Central Oregon talks about the high transportation costs in her area and how that was a barrier for her finding employment. Rising housing costs in Bend were making it hard for low-income residents to find adequate employment close to home. Lack of access to transportation can create a major barrier to employment, a barrier that Neighbor Impact's IDA program, that's one of our local partners, aims to break down by matching clients' money as they save for vehicles. Carrie Garfield graduated the program in November 2015, and she was finally able to buy a car. And Carrie says, "I'm in AA, and my sponsor told me about the program. I was on a bike. I had to get through rehab to get over obstacles and find a job. In the last 2 years, I had to get a job that was really close to home, like within a mile of my home, to ride my bike in the weather. So now I'm able to look for a better job." And she says, "I had never really saved for anything like that before, you know? So I just set a goal." The IDA program includes training and financial skills so that clients can continue saving after they graduate. Carrie says, "I've learned how to save money and plan for the future, and I've learned how to use credit and a savings account. The IDA program has helped me succeed in bettering my life. I'm so grateful to Neighbor Impact for everything that they have done for me."
So, Margaret?
Yes.
We're at time.
Okay, great.
So I'm really sorry that you got short-shrifted on this, but you get to be at the front end next time.
Thank you.
I think what's great about at least you starting off, I think having a visual, for me at least, seeing a person associated with a job makes it all more real. You got to introduce us to the to your report, which is in here. Mm-hmm. So your advantage is that you've piqued people's interest. You've given some really great success stories where people have skin in the game. That's one of the things I love about the IDA program. There's a responsibility to commit to it and a partnership from the state. So this is a very popular program. Now that you've seen that, I hope that you can do some weekend reading and see what's ahead, and then you have the advantage of starting off next time with your team. Right. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee.
Thank you for such engagement by this committee. It's great to see that interest in these issues.
Thank you.
And with that, I will close the hearing on the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.